an email, it's critical to me to cut this down. Mm. I really critically, it matters. So I want to validate whatever hypotheses I have and problems I have. I want to evaluate them. Once I've validated they even exist, I want to understand, are they blatant and critical? If they are not blatant and critical, they are not a good product development or investment for a new product. They might be a good product development if it's an upsell, especially if it was latent and critical. You know, if I've already got a market and 1 million users and I can upsell and educate my 1 million users about this latent problem they have that is actually critical, that might be fine. But if I'm not, if I'm trying to do it as this is the thing you buy from me as an actual core product on its own, first off, it's got to be blatant and critical. Because a startup and frankly, most organizations can't afford to educate the market.
Bonanza Growth Podcast, innovation, strategy, and UX for SaaS. Bonanza Studios is a growth consultancy for SaaS and fintech startups. Every SaaS business needs to fight in three different battles. First, product market fit, discovering a growing marketing and designing a compelling and undeniable solution to meet that demand. Second, product-led growth, turning your product into a growth vehicle by leveraging outcome-driven UX design. And third, creative marketing and organic brand building. If you're looking for a reliable partner to drive growth, check out our website at bonanza-studios.com.
Hey, Dave, thanks for coming on the podcast. Really excited.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to it.
So when we got in touch and I heard about your book, I was immediately interested to talk to you about the book and your career and what happened that you ended up writing the book and all that. So I let you basically drive the conversation. Maybe start with your background. What happened in your background, your career, that led you to write the product momentum gap, which is already few days out and got massive traction on different channels. So, Dave, tell us.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, the product momentum gap is out on Amazon, and yeah, right, it's doing really well. Bestseller status already on Kindle, which is super exciting. My background, you know, I've spent the last 20 odd years in product leadership, working with many different businesses and sectors, bridging the gap really between technology, the user, and the business, but from a leadership perspective. And throughout that career, I've had in various organizations, both startup, both PE-led, VC background, and some large, very established enterprises. I've seen similar challenges throughout, and probably the two main ones that relate to the book are leadership alignment, and specifically that's alignment of the product investment. How are we going to spend money building this thing or improving this thing? How is that going to actually generate value for the business and for the customer? And having alignment on that, we would normally call that product strategy, but having alignment on product strategy, so it's truly understood, measured, and executed and actioned effectively instead of constantly swapping and changing ideas. And then secondly, how we scale. And the challenge when organizations go from having really great traction within a segment of their market and then trying to go broader into inside that market and how they go about that. And that's specifically what we call, me and Andrew Osias, who I co-authored the book with, specifically what we call the product momentum gap. Mm-hmm. And that's that journey that when you go too broad, too fast, or even go broad in a non-systematic, not purposeful approach, rapidly end up slowing everything down, slowing down sales cycles, slowing down increasing churn, and slowing down product development, because your focus very quickly becomes very broad and distributed rather than purposeful and meaningful. And that's what the problem momentum gap really refers to how we overcome that, how we avoid that. Hopefully that kind of gives you a good introduction and all-rounder.
Basically, if I want to make a formula out of what you just shared with us, product momentum equals product strategy plus a plan for scale.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting way of looking at it, definitely. It is exactly that. And the key part is that most companies have a product strategy and some plans for scale, but they don't articulate it in a way that allows them to execute. And it's that piece that matters.
Yeah, I think the articulation is key because there is not enough literacy amongst leadership team, amongst senior team, about having a systematic view or process to draft their product strategy. It's often something that talked about in the workshops, in the brainstorming session, but no one says, okay, let's just systematically talk about what our product strategy is.
That's definitely true. And, one way of thinking about it is there's normally a lot of conversation and sometimes some phenomenally well-written documents around what the business goals are and the value we think we're going to give to our clients, to our users or customers, the value the customer will receive that will translate to us hitting our business goals, i.e. if we deliver this value for the customer, maybe it's saving them money, they will pay us this amount of money, therefore we win. The problem with that is that's only half of the journey. And when it comes to product, the actual work a product team does is they release features.
Yep.
They either release new ones or they improve existing ones or they remove features. They impact the features within the product. And what happens when that what actually happens? What's the direct impact? Well, the direct impact isn't immediately that customer value, because just releasing some features into the world does nothing. The impact is when a user clicks the buttons, taps the screen, when the user does something. So the impact is there's never any value created inside inside a client organization, especially in B2B software, until the user is using the feature and therefore their behavior changes. And it's that user behavior that's so crucial. And if we articulate our product strategy a little further, we expand it beyond just customer value, we go a little further to what's the user's behaviors that will create that value. We then articulate it in a way that both can be measured with some form of indicator, mm-hmm. and we can articulate it in a way that doesn't commit us to the solution. How the product creates that user behavior is still undefined. And that's really important, because otherwise the only way we have of articulating the product strategy is a product roadmap. And most companies, despite many great people trying to popularize more outcome-led roadmaps, most companies still have a roadmap, which is a timeline with features plotted on it. And the features are pretty specific,
Yes.
Which means we're committing to the solution and we don't know quite often that those solutions are actually going to deliver the outcomes we want. We have no idea. They're guesses. They're really big guesses as well. I mean, if we're doing this on an annual basis in January, we're guessing what we might build in Q4. There's a long way away. We don't know exactly. We probably don't have the right information and data to make those decisions. And more importantly, the people making those decisions, i.e. leadership setting out these big roadmaps, leadership are the wrong people to make those decisions. It needs to be the product squads. It needs to be the product managers, the designers, mm-hmm. and the engineers who are seeing the customer, talking to them, looking at the data in great detail, and really have that high level of exposure. And those teams, for companies that really win and deliver innovation, are able to iterate and try different solutions and then evolve and iterate until they find the right one and the best one. Where if we commit to a feature, 6 months, a year in ahead, we're not providing any opportunity for teams to do that. So in trying to overcome the momentum gap and trying to align teams, we want to express our strategies, expand how we express them so that we express them as user behaviors. And those behaviors then provide the guardrails for teams to go and work out the best features to achieve those, to maximize those behaviors. And they align leadership. If leadership can be aligned around, well, we agree, if sales and CS and product can agree that these behaviors are the behaviors that are going to create that value that we so much desire for our customers, then we can focus on those behaviors instead of everybody being product designers and product managers and engineers trying to come up with a solution. Like, we can let the experts do their job and focus and measure whether we're achieving the goal. We call that in the book the product value creation plan, and we go through the steps of how to do that, because it's not a task, and it's really important that people recognize it's not a task for a product leader to sit in their office on their own writing the strategy and building a product value creation plan. It's a collaborative process amongst leadership, and it's only that collaboration that creates the alignment.
I've got two questions here, because you basically unloaded a lot of insights here, and I want to make the best out of what you have shared with us. First of all, two things that you said. Like, first thing is like the product strategy, crafting it comes from collaboration of leadership team. My question on that is, how do you envision this collaboration? How should it be done or conducted? Second, you said that and I resonate with that a lot. Often I see drafts of product strategy is very future focused or insinuating what we need to build rather than what kind of behavior we want to influence, right? And I think that's a really key to, it's huge in my opinion, as the way you said it, that's important. If you can share an example of a product strategy that is based around influencing behavior, like through example, that I think would be really beneficial for our audience as well.
Yeah, certainly. I'm just thinking about some of the examples in the book. Just trying to quickly look some up. I don't have the right page open in front of me. But the first question you mentioned there was how to conduct that collaboration. Mm-hmm. And there is really, I think, no better way than collaborative workshops where we're working together, ideally in a facilitated manner rather than self-facilitating, so there's a third party helping the leaders go through the journey so that everybody can participate fully in the experience. But in the book, we outline a set of templates, which are effectively could be viewed as a set of topics for workshops. And it starts with the customer value mapper. And it looks a very simple, it's a one-page template. It simply has business goals. It then expresses what the value to the customer is and why it's important to the customer. There's only a few boxes to fill in on the page. But when I've ran this with work in workshop environments, as a consultant, I do that now and then, and with leadership teams, it's really surprising how the room doesn't agree on some of these real basic points. So the first part is to take that really simple, direct templates that are in the book and use them in a workshop environment to drive the conversation and the debate until we get to a place where we agree. That's the first step. And some of the work that needs to happen, depending on the level of debate, might be that we don't have enough information and evidence as a leadership team agree on this. And we need to then go do some, that's where the product leader can then drive product discovery work, strategic level discovery work, to go and find more information and bring that data back to the DLT, back to that leadership team. But at other times, you know, in a more established organization or more established product lines, that knowledge will already exist in the business, and then I'll have the evidence already, and it's a case of aligning everybody around what we've already got. Does that answer the question on how things are conducted?
That is. One follow-up question on this is that you mentioned that you observe some resistance towards leaders when you are trying to basically navigate their focus towards what kind of customer values we are going to create out of this campaign, so to speak. Can you walk me through these resistances, of what natures they are, and why do you think you observing them?
Yeah, I think there's the challenge with leadership teams or in organizations is, unsurprisingly, people in leadership positions have strong opinions, and clear ideas of what they believe is the right direction to go. And those, quite often, the evidence they're looking at that informs those ideas, which typically isn't done quite that systematically, it's done organically. But the evidence they receive, which of course is often full of lots of bias, is typically very siloed. It's, you know, the sales guy is going to hear the win-loss, the reasons is the sales leader is going to hear the reason that they're sales reps are giving for not closing deals. They're going to listen to that noise, that information. The customer service leader is going to be hearing the noise, what's the repeated loudest noise they get, what's the frequent challenge they get. So that they're all hearing different evidence. And part of the process of bringing it all together in a workshop environment is to normalize the level of noise and to expose everybody to the broader holistic picture so that they're not just thinking about their world. And, you know, that's a challenge for the leaders in leadership teams. They have to take off their departmental head, the head of being a department. They have to take that hat off and put on the hat of being a leader within the organization and thinking holistic for the business. And, you know, their incentivizations as an employee and what makes them a hero and helps them grow and get their career growth is often in that silo and not holistically. So they're going to have strong opinions, and it's through debate and conversation with clear focus of what we're trying to answer, which the templates in the book really help with, that and good facilitation helps with, that you get that alignment.
What you said about normalization of biases is a massive, massive, massive bottleneck for decision making, especially amongst folks that know the topic very well, or they're very, very skilled or proficient in their own function. So let me just give you an example. I cannot go so much in detail because it's a current client, but we are helping clients with their PMF, product market fit activities, and they want to know which areas are the most lucrative to basically what are the low-hanging fruits when it comes to their go-to-market strategy. So there are multiple areas that they identified, and we sort of identified several factors, variables that could be decisive, right? We basically did a viability score, because to basically assess each of these areas, we had to basically look into five different variables, like what's the contract value, what's the difficulty of solving that case, so to speak, for our customers, what's the immediate return. So if we solve it, do we get paid quickly from the from our customers? And then we look into the there are some market variables, like, hey, this topic, we have to put our ads in front of our audience to know that we can do this for them. What's the cost per click? What's the average monthly searches? So when we look at the areas that we wanted to basically prioritize from by looking at all these variables, then we identify certain biases that their leadership team that basically they had, right? And there was one incident, one of these areas. I want to go in details because normalization is a very key topic here. One of the areas they were really fixated on, that, hey, we can deliver this, we can do this for our customers, da da da. But we look into the market side of things, we realize that the average monthly searches in the market that they want to start with is very low, and the cost per click are astronomically high. So when we run, when we assess all these areas based on all these variables and normalize their effects, we score them against each other, that area that everyone was initially fixated on, at least the CEO, got scored the lowest. So we did prioritize that activity because essentially that was crazy. If you wanted to go after that area, we had to spend at least 10 times than average in marketing spend to be able to compete, right? So it, and then I, when we run, when we gone through that exercise with that clients, then sort of I reflect innovation project that I've conducted in the past years, and I realized that, oh my goodness, innovation bias, innovator bias is a real thing. It's actually, it's a very, very, very severe topic that needs to be addressed head on before we want to craft a product strategy.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is, I see it all the time as well. I totally agree. The bias is what excites people and their motivations for wanting to do things, and where their passion comes from. And remember, you know, a founder is a great example, or an innovator. You know, they've got to be passionate about the thing in order to care enough to innovate, to think about the problem enough and put that energy into it. Those areas, unfortunately, are not always aligned. The areas people are passionate about with what would be a good business decision or a good business investment. Passion does not equal good business investment.
100%.
I think what you're describing there, it's really important to recognize, I think, from a product perspective, from where I come from, that the business strategy and the product strategy are two separate things. The product strategy exists to serve and deliver the business strategy. And I see a lot of times where the two are merged, or we aren't thinking about the two separately, especially in single product businesses where they view, well, we don't need a business strategy, or we don't need a product strategy because we've got one of either or, rather than no, that we need both. So like the questions you were just asking, really valid questions that the LT team should all be contributing, the leadership team should, or the exec co, whatever you call it, should all be contributing to towards those business strategic decisions. You know, really what you were describing there, where you had metrics and parameters to evaluate what the total addressable market was and what the obtainable market was. You know, your search volume was a parameter, was a proxy for addressable market. Your cost per click was a proxy for obtainable market. I mean, we can't afford to obtain all this market. It's too expensive. The addressable market is, you know, the search volume informs that a little bit. So, you know, their business strategy, core business strategy things that you know you'd expect, especially in a VC funded business. You'd expect the organization to understand well. But the product strategy is there to serve those things after those decisions have been made. And those, you know, the CEO owns that, of course, or the founder or whoever it is, in a larger company, there'll be a general manager or an MD. But everybody has to contribute to that. That's the responsibility of the entire LT. And if that process is put together, and it often is because of the way investments works and going and capturing VC capital, if that process is done with the management team being involved, without the leadership team having their input and buy into it, you end up immediately with misalignment before we even start to talk about misalignment in product. What often I will get involved, the companies will approach me to say, we need some help, we're misaligned, we have these challenges, our product strategy, we're failing to execute it, blah, 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 blah. And, one of the first things is to talk to them about what's the business strategy. And if that's missing, then the leadership team's got to work on that first. It's a prerequisite. It's a prerequisite. We can't talk about how the product is going to support the organization to achieve its goals when the business hasn't worked out why it exists, who it wants to serve, and what its goals are.
To your point, like when it comes to the SaaS world, product drive the business. It's the main driver of the business. So often founders or executive teams interchangeably use business strategy and product strategy. To a certain extent, it's true. But again, when you look at the business model, it's only the customer side is only part of the business model. You need to have understanding of your cost structure, your suppliers, the resources that you need. Is it how much AWS you need? And then marketing channels. So the differentiation between business strategy and product strategy becomes even more highlighted when you look into e-commerce, when you look into businesses that are not software driven or partially software driven. Then definitely these two needs to be separated. And I'll also tell my clients, SaaS clients, is like, you need to have at least two exercises, different exercises. Start with your product strategy because that's a key driver of your business. But then you need to look into your business model as well. Because again, the product strategy only concerns about top right of your business model, so to speak. And the rest is about how your business is going to survive and thrive.
Completely. I think there's a, in SaaS, most of my work personally is in B2B SaaS businesses.
Right.
And when I think about what you've just said there, there is a target audience we've decided to serve. There is a market we've decided that, has an underserved need, and we've decided to solve it. And products there to understand that underserved need in detail, really get to the root cause, find out how we can create value for the customer that will align to our business goals, and then deliver a solution for it and make sure that solution really does fit and wows the customer, etc. And like you just mentioned, that problem that we've identified as an underserved need, as an organization and product have really delved deeper on, that there is often a case where that same problem exists in a different market, or the same problem could be positioned and framed completely differently, but it's the same problem. And I think, the positioning of how we take that to market, that piece of product marketing or the model, there's many business in different ways. We SaaS is obviously a business model. You're going to pay me a subscription of some basis based on some sort of term to be able to use my software. But there's still many different ways that organizations shape that and many different ways that go to market, whether it's totally freemium, whether it's sales-led, whether it's trial, whether it's free forever. There's all sorts of different options. So there's more than just the product itself, of whether the product works for the customer and solves the problem, that will drive success. We could have a business that has a suboptimal product, but a very optimized channel, marketing channels, and very optimized go-to-market approach, and where the product is a good channel fit, which is something we don't talk about enough. Is the product a good channel fit? Then, and succeed very much so compared to another business where the product potentially was far better fit, far better for the users, far more capable, far bigger outcomes for them, but the go-to-market approach was the piece that was suboptimal. And who's to say which of the two will succeed in that space? So every business, whether they're software focused or not, can't ignore that there has to be a business strategic thinking as well as the product strategy.
100%. And that's why it's called product market fit. Not only finding what that product should feel like or look like is not enough. It's only one side of the equation. The other side is the market, right? To your point, what's the channel we are driving? We are leveraging to drive engagement. How does it work? And then often what I bump into, Dave, I would like to get your ideas on this. Those founding team or startups that are really heavily product focused, they end up with product with broad set of features that fit no market.
Yes, there are companies that definitely end up with a set of features that fit no market, and I don't think they're always. I think maybe what's useful is to backtrack a little and just talk about PMF or product market fit for a second,
right?
Because you mentioned a few points around that I think feed into that question. I think firstly is to recognize that it's not a binary thing. Product market fit. You don't have product market fit. You have a weaker or a stronger fit. Mm-hmm. And product market fit can change without you doing anything. As you pointed out, there are two parts of it. There's the product and the market. If a new competitor comes in tomorrow doing something very different, the dynamics of the market is going to change. Or if the market itself changes for whatever reason, due to economy, regulations, there's lots of things that will drive change in the market. So it's not static. I think the other point to make is market is often not actually defined very well. And this is a big part of the Product Momentum book topic, actually, that we often, you might be MarTech tool for retailers. Plenty of those. There's a massive amount. It's a very saturated sector. But let's say you're a MarTech tool and your target is retailer. There are many different kinds of retailers. That's a massive sector still.
Absolutely.
That you could be a supermarkets, which are a completely different kind of retailer, to a electronics store, completely different to large scale shops that run more by appointment sales, like furniture, for example. Completely different again to a Costa coffee shop, which is a retailer. There's their needs and challenges, or a department store, say, or their needs and challenges are completely different. How they operate their business, what their margins are, how they work, what they do, the things they've got to think about, how their customers consider them, whether they sell 1,000 products or whether they sell 10 products. All these things are vastly different. And from a marketing perspective, if I'm marketing inside those companies, my needs are going to be different. The needs of somebody in a furniture store marketing are not the same needs as to somebody marketing in a coffee shop. Yep. So they're different needs. They have different requirements. And so if I've got a strong PMF in retail, the likelihood is I don't have a strong PMF in retail. The likelihood is I have a strong PMF in one of those segments, let's say supermarkets.
Yeah.
And the problem becomes we don't recognize product quite often, don't define that, understand where the traction really is with the revenue and where the fit is its strongest. And then we go a little broader. You know, that organization gets funded. It does well in one niche. It's got a few customers outside of that niche segment inside retail. So it calls itself retail. It wants to shout about the broader segment when it comes to fundraising because it's a bigger story. It's a bigger TAM. So, you know, it attracts a bigger valuation. But the reality is that they're actually really good at one part of the market, one segment. But they've almost drink their own Kool-Aid during that journey. And as they go through funding, you know, and they pop out the other side as a Series A business and start spending more money, they go hire more salespeople and more marketing people. And before we know it, we're talking to the entire market. We have the ability now to not just talk in that niche where we were winning, but we're now talking to all of those different kinds of retailers that I've mentioned. And we're starting to try and make deals in all of those different kinds. And because our fit isn't as strong, our product market fit isn't as strong in all of those sectors, all of those subsectors, sorry, those segments, we start to get, that's when we start to get that sales pressure where we start to get, if we had this feature, I could close the deal. If I had this feature, I could close the deal. Customers are asking me for this. And we forget at that point to organize that information, that learning by the segments. And we start going, so our retail customers do need feature X and they need feature Y. So we build feature X and feature Y. And the reality is what we've just done is we've made our product slightly better fit, probably in one sector on one side and another sector on another side. So we're not actually making our product strong, properly strong fit in a new segment inside retail. We're just making it mediocrely better in multiple sectors at once. And that obviously does not move the needle. It spends money. It allows us to spend a lot of cash.
Yeah.
And it allows us to end up with a lot of feature bloat and say we do all these things. Yeah. But it doesn't mean we have high appeal and strong fit to another segment in the market that's going to buy us and allow us to go deep within that segment. And that's when we end up slowing down sales cycles, increasing churn because we're not as good a fit, starting to miss our business goals and our business targets. And from the product standpoint, from an investment standpoint, it looks like we're spending loads of money building loads of features but not getting any return, which then puts challenge somewhere along the line on the product leader of, well, the money you're spending isn't helping us get a return. And then that's the point where everybody in the leadership is misaligned. Everybody's got their own agenda of what they think should be the right thing to spend money on. And we end up going through this death cycle, really, of killing growth. Growth slows down and slows down. There's probably still year-on-year growth, but we're way off that hockey stick curve we put in that investment plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, way off the growth we actually want. We're just an average growing business. So the businesses that really win, that's how you end up with a product with a broad set of features serving a large sector poorly. And you end up, companies that do the opposite, that do achieve super high growth, are extremely good at not organically going after the wider market, but systematically picking the next segment and understanding who they target. In the book, we have a tool called the product value pyramid. And the very bottom of the pyramid is who are you serving? Who's the target audience? And that's the piece that I think it's scary for leaders, scary for founders to say, our next focus is going to be this segment. Because that segment, you know, we're just going to focus on coffee shops next. Yeah. That's a scary thing because it sounds small. Now, if you go and do the business work on it and realize that if they are deep in coffee shops, it's worth millions and millions of pounds. It's an enormous market.
It's absolutely enormous.
But as you say it, compared to the big the overall retail sector, it suddenly sounds very small, so it becomes scary. And we're more, the businesses that go deep and then go move sideways and go deep again, they're the ones that win. Doesn't mean you don't do business with companies that are what in the wider sector, or it means you don't invest product development to go after them. It means we're not spending that product money to go after them. And we're probably spending less or marketing effort and sales effort to go after the broader market. We won't turn the business away, but we know that our product is not designed to be 100% optimal for that group yet. So when they come back with those requests, we accept that we're not going to do them, mm-hmm. because we're going deep in a different sector right now. And that knowing when we're saying no on purpose, then rather than reactive tactics of destroying the strategy.
100%. This last 10 minutes was gold. And I think you have given such an elaborate description of PMF, product market fit, that anyone else came on the podcast. So I thank you for that. I always, if I want to summarize it, is that for startups, especially SaaS startups, because the founder come to, not often, but sometimes they come in, they're happy, they raise money 3 months ago, 6 months ago, 1 month ago, and they are sort of like heated by that new blood, so to speak. And then I tell them that you got not so much time left. They're like, no, we just raised 2 million. It's like, you have no idea how fast we can burn 2 million. It's nothing. It's nothing. And on top of it, you typically have 12 months to 18 months to hit the growth rate that hopefully agreed upon when you were raising that investment round with your investors. You got to get to 2x, 3x, at least to show that you have a business case. You've got your business fundamentals right. So investors would be willing to put more money into it. So essentially, you don't have time. And that's the reality of startup world, especially venture capital startup world, that unless you want to bootstrap, which is very noble, and I applaud you if you want to go bootstrap. But when you are in the venture world, it's all about hitting massive growth target in such a relatively short amount of time. So essentially from day one, you got to be worried about your next funding round.
Yes, completely agree. And that journey that you've just mentioned there, the money lands in your bank. You've got to start spending it in order to get the growth. It doesn't make you money sitting in the bank, and that normally means you've got to hire people. And hiring people is slow. Have got notice periods. You've got to find them. You've got to find the right talent. You mustn't hire the wrong people, or else things will be a disaster. And as you hire those people, you've got to keep them aligned to that focus, and that's a tough piece. That's where things go wrong. All this new blood comes into the business with great experience and ideas, but that just creates a huge risk of distraction and diffusion. And you're at a point where you don't have that opportunity, especially in SaaS, where there might be not all SaaS companies suffer this, but a lot of SaaS companies struggle with the fact that the sales cycle isn't as short as they would like. There's a lot of SaaS companies where the sales cycle is 6 months. So if I've only got an 18-month runway, I only actually have 12 months to close the deals that will impact my next round. Because that pipeline that I will obviously try and help in my next round, it's still only it's still only in the funnel. It's not closed. It's still a risk that it might not close. So I want to see them if I'm part of the investor in the next round, I really want to be counting not just the pipeline, but what you've actually shown, the traction you've demonstrated. So we've got to really focus on how we do that at speed. And that goes back to not panicking that we've got to go broad, but
100%.
Getting this normally in the niche they already had immense traction in, there's normally plenty of opportunities to still go deep.
100%.
We just feel this fear, so we go broader instead. We think we need a bigger pool, but we don't. There was still plenty of fish in the little pool. We didn't need a bigger pool. So, I think that's crucial. And in the book, we talk about something called, I mentioned it a few times, the product value creation plan.
Yes.
And even if you're not part of the process of creating it, because that's part of a challenge, decisions got made, new heart, as you scale post-funding, you bring in new people in and the decisions are already made. It does at least give you a measurable tool to keep everybody aligned.
100%.
Measurable, clear targets. We're aiming to change these 7 user behaviors. That's how we're going to succeed. This is our thesis. And the materials you created to build the value creation plan, the different templates, often really useful, phenomenal tools for onboarding new people because they can review those and they're easy to read. They're human readable. They make total sense after the fact. So you can understand the thesis behind why that's important. And that does 2 really important things for the founder for scaling. It allows his thesis to be, allows the thesis to be challenged by that new blood. They might have some experience that suggests there's a massive flaw in the strategy. I'd rather find that out early than late. And it allows new blood to align to the existing strategy so that their energies and excitement and their new vigor and passion that they've joined with is all driven in the right place. So we're all paddling in the same direction.
Yeah. To add to this is that we just gone through a rebranding this year. In the past 3.5 years, Dave Bonanza basically was a design agency catering a broad range of customers. We offer innovation, UX design, and increasingly growth, right? Services. So we just this year we've gone through this exercise of crafting a strategy and like aligning the team, and we realized that okay, let's just look at the past 3.5 years, what kind of clients we've served, what kind of clients, more importantly, we had really good success stories, right? It's not about just serving clients, it's about creating impact. And then we realized that increasingly the project that we enjoyed the most working with and created the outcome, and they came back for more. They were related to SaaS, especially SaaS fintech, right? So we were like, why don't we just focus on this? It's a big market already. It's a big pool. It's a small pool relatively, but has depth, right? And then after we basically decided to go after SaaS fintech, then things got a lot easier. To your point, marketing, what should we do with marketing? Let's just come up with campaigns that talk about the needs of SaaS fintech. Sales, who should we go after? Oh, okay, easy, right? Tools, processes, skills, developing services, what should we do? Whatever needed to serve better our target market, right? Certain services we deprioritized because they didn't need it. Certain services we strengthen because that's what matters to them. And also in terms of findability, we have observed in the past 2 months some of the fastest closing sales cycles I ever witnessed. Like literally one client came through us through our meetup channel, read that we are SaaS, a growth partner for SaaS startups, went through our two pages, homepage and UX design page, read our case study, which is we have a very elaborate case study, and decided it's a good fit. They came on the call. We had the initial call, second call with design team, third interaction, sending the contract.
That's an amazing story. And it's the same for, that's exactly the same for a SaaS business, and the product VCP, value creation plan, helps the business manage and direct that in exactly the same way you've just described. You know, your description is perfect. You know, your clients that you are paying, you've got a limited, as every business has, not just yes. you, a limited amount of marketing dollars. No business is infinite. You have a limited amount of marketing spend. You want the highest conversion you can get for that, the highest ROI. You want a product that's most likely to sell, and you want the cash to come in quick, because you know, because cash is king. So we've got, by everything you just described, meant your positioning of the product, the service, everything you offer resonated so much higher with those, with that audience. And you've proven that past performance that you thought was good was mediocre, because you've demonstrated amazing turnover, amazing sales cycle, and demonstrated that that is actually possible, that it doesn't have to be a long, drawn-out process, because the person you were speaking to understood, trusted you, understood you knew them and understood their problems. Now, your market fit was really high. Now, you couldn't have possibly achieved that high market fit and that rapid sales cycle and probably high lifetime customer value over time in the future. I'm speculating, I'm sure it will be. You couldn't have achieved that if it was a broad, generic message, because it's whilst it feels like that broad, generic approach is going to give you a bigger pond to fish in, it's counterintuitive, because the customer is less interested to use, and the service you offered, you talk about how you remove certain tools and double down in other areas. That's like features in a product.
Yes.
You change your feature set and you double down on the ones that really resonated and would help that particular segment you're chasing. It's exactly the same. You've got a lovely case study sort of proving the point. Now, it doesn't stop you going broader, but it means when you can afford to widen that segment and make it, it's a good business decision that you are comfy with. When you're ready, if indeed you ever need to be ready, you might be able to hit all your targets and growth in the segment you're in that fintech SaaS segment. But if you at some point decided that that's not big enough and it does need to be broader, you've saturated it, you will be able to do that in a systematic way rather than organic. You'll be able to target the next segment and double down and go deep in that segment next, and maximize every dollar you're spending holistically in the business, not just in the part that's looking after the product.
I think I would love to invite you for the part two, because this has been such a great conversation for me, tapping into your experience. For the last part, I want you to sort of like share your experience and thoughts on picking. So you talk about product value creation map, right? Product value map, right? So especially in the strategy workshops that the team want to align on an initiative, let's say it's a massive business, they're thinking about diversification and looking into a new business potential. And let's say this business has an app, like it's a SaaS, right? And I noticed that you use Superhuman as an email app, email client app, right? The story of Superhuman has been really interesting to me, because they came out in a very saturated market, or a very monopolistic market, let's say, that you've got massive clients, massive email clients like Gmail, Bing, Microsoft, I don't know which one, Microsoft email. And they said, like, you know what, we're going to focus on delivering the fastest email client experience. So for me, this is such a daring task to say, okay, we are going to go into a very saturated monopolistic market and deliver on a value that the likes of Gmail couldn't deliver. So what does it take for a product team or executive team to get to this level of conviction that say, you know what, we can do it. Let's go deliver on some of the most challenging product values that we could deliver, and let's deliver on that.
That's a great question. I mean, I think Superhuman is a really interesting example and use case. And I don't know their history properly, but so I can't talk to use them as a great case study. But I do use the product and talk about why I use it and then extrapolate to how that might impact product decision making and investments. You know, my background before I was in product, so quite a long time ago, was in software engineering.
Yeah.
You know, I was a C++ software engineer. So I'm really quite comfortable with a UI that looks like a black screen with some text. I'm very comfortable with it. I'm also more productive in that environment.
Fair enough.
You know, the super users of every product are more productive with shortcuts, etc. They don't need, the more they can do on the keyboard, unless they have to move their mouse, the more productive. That's a pretty common thing. You know, if you look at somebody using Excel, there's a super user. They're clicking all these shortcuts and things are happening, and you're like, "Whoa, how is that? How did that?" Where I'm using Excel, clicking the UI, trying to work out which menu it's in, and they've already hit Control Shift L or whatever. I don't even know if that's a shortcut. I made it up, but you get the point. So I think what Superhuman did for me, their appeal was, "Hey, I can be productive." I can be more productive. Email is an extremely comp task, as a task that takes up an extreme amount of my time.
That's right.
And I can be more productive and do this faster thanks to a bunch of shortcuts. And there isn't a UI to do half the things. There isn't, they didn't design a, I can't click to do most of the things. I have to learn the shortcuts. I have to learn how to just tap the keyboard. So, firstly, their target audience was one that was comfortable to learn how to use the tool. That's secondly, right. Their target audience was one that was comfortable using the keyboard, not the mouse. That they're the experiences they've got to assume. Their assumptions are there is a group of people that are comfortable with those two points. If I was thinking about their business at the beginning, they would be some of my hypotheses. My product hypotheses would be, I believe we can create a more productive tool, save people time if they use the keyboard more and put the effort in to learn the tool. And that's like any hypothesis, I'm going to test it. You know, that's product discovery work, a capability that unfortunately too many teams don't have. You know, there's amazing books by people like Teresa Torres on continuous discovery. There's far better qualified at that than me to talk about it. But having that clear hypothesis and then running experimentation, whether it's generative or whether it's validation, to go and learn more or validate your ideas, your hypotheses, ideally with as little code or no code, that would be better, to learn whether that market exists, whether there's a demand and a need. And when I think about B2B software specifically, I always think about this. I always have this 4x4 in my mind when we think about strategic, high-level strategic investment like this. And the 4x4, down one axis, it had the y-axis, it has blatant and latent. So the two rows, is the problem blatant or is the problem latent? And a blatant problem is the customer can tell me I have this problem. I can tell you I spend all way too many hours in email. It takes me too long. very blatant. If it was latent, I wouldn't know. I have the problem, but I wouldn't be aware of it. So, you know, I might not be aware that I spend so much time in email. On the x-axis, there's aspirational and critical. So I might aspire to save time in email, but it really doesn't matter to me that much. Maybe I only spend 20 minutes a day looking at my email. Yeah, if it was 15, that'd be quite nice, but it's not really that important to me. I might spend 4 hours a day in email. It's critical to me to cut this down. I really critically, it matters. So I want to validate whatever hypotheses I have and problems I have. I want to evaluate them. Once I've validated they even exist, I want to understand, are they blatant and critical? If they are not blatant and critical, they are not a good product development or investment for a new product. They might be a good product development if it's an upsell, especially if it was latent and critical. You know, if I've already got a market and 1 million users and I can upsell and educate my 1 million users about this latent problem they have that is actually critical, that might be fine. But if I'm not, if I'm trying to do it as this is the thing you buy from me as an actual core product on its own, first off, it's got to be blatant and critical. Because a startup and frankly, most organizations can't afford to educate the market. It's latent. And if it's aspirational, then I'm bound to companies having money to burn, which there are a few of those. You know, I mean, aspirational products are more in B2C land. You know, that's why people spend more money on a car that gives them a, you know, a ego boost and all the rest and makes them look better in the world. It's aspiration. It's not a, it's not because the car gets them from A to B in any quicker, you know. In fact, many, or you know, often it performs worse. It guzzles more fuel or pollutes the earth more. But the it's I play on in B2B, aspiration isn't going to close deals. Aspiration isn't going to be the thing that makes the person buying the product improve their job opportunity and career, which at the end of the day, it's in the back of everybody's mind when they buy a product in B2B. Will my decision help me grow? So it's got to be blatant and critical. Does that help?
That's fantastic. That was a crash course on prioritization, where to focus. And wow, thank you a lot, Dave. I appreciate it that you came on the podcast, really share your values. I can clearly see why your product quickly became a bestseller. I encourage everyone else who's listening to this podcast to get a copy of it. I am going to actually get it now. Dave, any last words?
Really, thank you very much for having us on board, having me on board. Me and Andrea really enjoyed writing the book. It was an amazing process. We learned lots. And, you know, I'd love anybody who does buy the book, please leave a review on Amazon, because reading the reviews is really helping fuel our ideas for the future.
We will do so. Thanks a lot. Until next episode, folks. Well, keep it healthy.
Thank you for listening to this episode. For more information, go to bonanza-studios.com.